Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Coming to you live today, January 25th, 2009. Well, you don't have to be a weatherman to know which way the wind's blowing in our economy. Due south at high speeds. One of the weak spots of our media system historically has been its ability to understand the economy, communicate it, and let citizens participate in the decisions that will affect our economic futures. Today we have as our guest one of the really outstanding economists and political economists of our time to discuss his brand new book, The Predator State. Our guest is James Galbraith, professor of economics at the University of Texas. A terrific book, a terrific guest, an enlightening book. Should be a wonderful hour. Stay tuned and join us for this hour. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Is Comcast favoring its own digital phone service over others? The Federal Communications Commission is investigating the nation's largest cable provider for degrading the sound quality of competing internet phone services while leaving the company's own digital voice service unaffected. Free Press and Public Knowledge filed a letter with the FCC back in October asking the agency to investigate. Last week, the FCC sent a letter to Comcast asking for clarification of its practices concerning so-called Voice over Internet Protocol, or VoIP, services. Free Press Counsel Chris Riley explains.
The FCC found a distinction between telecommunications service, which was available to offer raw transit, and an information service, which offered transit in conjunction with some other features. And so what the FCC is doing in this letter is it's looking into that distinction.
Telecommunications services are subject to different rules than information services.
It's really about the payment systems that underlie the phone networks. This is an incredibly rich and complex system of laws and regulations. The public isn't as aware of just how much money gets shuffled around in the background among all of these phone companies for the phone calls and the internet traffic that's being made. And companies who offer information services are, by and large, not required to pay into this system.
That money, called intercarrier compensation obligations, goes to support rural phone providers and a number of other high-cost portions of the telephone network. By separating out their VoIP service, Comcast has essentially become a phone service, a categorization Comcast has worked hard to avoid. The company now has a choice to treat their voice service as a true voice over IP service and not favor their own system over any other, or to be a phone service and operate under telecommunications rules.
The clearest benefit here to consumers is in the promotion and protection of competition of VoIP services. We don't want to see Comcast giving a secret competitive advantage to its own VoIP service product over competing VoIP service products like Vonage and Skype. And I think that the biggest repercussion of this, customers will see a more level and more fair playing field, and will see more investment into competing VoIP products like Vonage and Skype, and will have better choices and better quality products.
In December, the bloggers at Progress Illinois found their YouTube account suspended. The reason? They had posted video clips from local Fox affiliate WFLD. Progress Illinois, an online news and commentary website, had posted short excerpts from three broadcasts. The posts used the video clips to support their commentary and credited Fox Chicago as the source for the footage. One of the posts even commended the Fox affiliate for its reporting. Fox complained that this was a violation of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, or DMCA, and demanded that YouTube take down the videos. YouTube responded by suspending Progress Illinois' account, taking with it more than 100 videos compiled by the organization, including more than 25 originals. Paul Levy, an attorney for Public Citizen, which is representing Progress Illinois in the dispute, explains that Fox's actions are an abuse of fair use and have far-reaching implications.
Progress Illinois made what would seem to be some pretty straightforward fair use excerpting from news programs, and the result of having multiple claims of infringement filed at YouTube was that their entire YouTube account was shut down to the extent that bloggers depend on access to posting facilities such as YouTube. The threat of having them taken down based on spurious claims of fair use has the potential for suppressing useful and entirely protected speech online.
While laws like the DMCA were established to protect intellectual property, there are provisions that protect the use of copyrighted material for certain purposes.
Taking of a small portion, using them in a transformative manner for purposes of commentary, using it for the purposes of non-commercial speech as opposed to strictly commercial activity. There are simply a series of factors, and applying those factors, we think it's clear that the using of small excerpts from long interviews was fair use.
Some say it's not YouTube's policies, but the DMCA itself that needs revising.
The DMCA provides for automatic takedowns based on the mere assertion that there's infringing activity going on. It's our view that incidents like this illustrate the problem with allowing automatic takedown.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Greetings, everyone. This is Bob McChesney. Welcome to Media Matters. Hope you enjoyed our musical interlude there, and sorry for the delay getting on to today's program. This is WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our program has, over the past several years, put a special emphasis on economics. The media's coverage of economic issues, or lack thereof, and as often is the case, and we've featured on this show over the years, economists, the stature of Joseph Stiglitz, Paul Krugman, political economists like Bob Kuttner, Dean Baker. And it's our privilege today to have a wonderful economist joining us who has a terrific brand new book. Our guest, a professor at the University of Texas at Austin, James Galbraith, author of the brand new book, The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandoned the Free Markets and Why Liberals Should Too. Rarely have I read a book that was so timely to the crisis we are in today, and written in an accessible style that a lay reader can understand, yet one that doesn't talk down to lay readers. Professor Galbraith, welcome to Media Matters. Professor Galbraith, are you there?
You hear me?
Yes, I hear you fine, sir. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
There's so much to cover in this book, and this is not false praise or hype to say how much I enjoyed it. It's really one of the best books on economics I've read in years. And it's a book I recommend to anyone who is interested in understanding the situation we're in today in the United States and in the world. And let me just ask you, if I can, why did you decide to write this book? What was your motivation? And why the title? Why The Predator State?
Okay. Why did I decide to write it? Well, I think I wrote it because I needed to give expression to matters that have been troubling me over the entire length of my career. I grew up, of course, in a tradition which was deeply at odds with the prevailing currents in economics, which were, of course, deeply libertarian, deeply committed to minimizing the role of government and maximizing the role of the market. And I never felt comfortable with those, with the that worldview, but I'd never given a comprehensive critique of it either. So I thought this book would be an opportunity to do that. Why did I call it the predator state? Well, for two reasons. One of them, a matter of intellectual history, the concept of predatory conduct in economics goes back to one of the greatest American economists, Thorstein Veblen, but had dropped from view in mainstream discussion. And secondly, I felt that the phrase, the predator state, captured the way in which conservatism had been changed and had, in fact, been subverted, particularly in the last 8 years in the Bush administration, in a way which moved people who called themselves conservatives away from the principles of small government libertarianism and toward basically the use of power on behalf of a very small number of powerful clients. And that, as I say, the phrase the predator state seemed to capture that reasonably well.
Well, the book does, as you say, go through the conservative economic doctrines of the past 30 years and I think systematically address them and show how they've been abandoned and by conservatives and acknowledge that they really are irrelevant or flawed. But it does far more than that. And before we go into much detail, I do want to alert our listeners that this book speaks directly to the crisis the United States is in economically today. And it's as fine a book I've read, and I've read many of them, that does that. And, of course, you finished the book, I imagine, by looking at your preface approximately a year ago, just a little over a year ago. But it could have been written, frankly, yesterday, because you fully anticipate the crisis that we enter, the financial crisis. And if I could ask you, before we go into the detail of the book, if you could have a half hour with President Obama and sit down and he said, Professor Galbraith, tell me what I should do to straighten out our economy. And you've got what would be on your list of things you would urge him to do? And then having said that, could you evaluate what he's proposed to do so far?
Wow. Well, do we have a half an hour?
We have a full hour.
All right, I'll try not to take a half an hour to answer that question. I think the first point, the overarching point that one has to appreciate is that this crisis, these events, don't have a precedent in our professional lives and, for that matter, in the actual lifetime of most Americans. We're looking at something which is a throwback to the late 1920s and early 1930s. It's not just a recession that we're in, and it's not just a problem of parts of the banking sector. We're looking here at what has been the thoroughgoing collapse of the financial system, which is the major, is the source of growth, the source of activity in the private sector. That collapse is, well, I think the word I'd use for it is organic. Past recessions in our lifetimes have largely been caused by shocks to the system, oil price increases, rising interest rates, things of that nature, which were basically things that slowed down an otherwise substantially healthy system. We're looking here at something fundamental to the architecture of the system itself. And so two things follow from that. One is that the public sector's reaction has to be on a bigger scale than anything we've seen in the post-war period, or it's probably not going to work. And the other is that the reconstruction of the financial sector has to be very thoroughgoing and has to be undertaken with a pretty long time horizon, because the financial sector itself cannot simply be made to restart. It has to regain the trust of all of its customers, both in the U.S. and around the world, and it has to be run in such a way that it is doing something really fundamentally different from what it was doing in the last couple of decades, and particularly in the last few years. And until those changes are made, efforts to simply restore the system to the situation before the crisis are, in my view, not going to work.
Now, do you think, looking at the team that President Obama has put in place at Treasury and as his advisors, do you think they're sympathetic to your position, or do you think it's going to be a hard pill for them to swallow?
I have a lot of respect for the group that the president has assembled, and I wish them well. I think the initial bill, the recovery package, which is basically the work of the Congress, of Speaker Pelosi and the chairman of the Appropriations Committee, Dave Obey, and the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, Charles Rangel, is a good bill and should pass. But I don't think that the team has, I'm quite sure it doesn't fully share my perspective on these matters. And I think there are, I see two issues. One is a belief that this will be over fairly soon, a belief which has its origins in the way in which people are accustomed to modeling the economy, models which basically say, well, we're having a deviation from equilibrium, a deviation from a normal condition, and we will return to normal over some time frame, 3 or 4 years, if we do nothing. And that's the basic way in which government forecasts are made. And it, to me, it, in this environment, is deeply problematic because it basically projects the post-war experience onto a situation which, as I say, doesn't have a precedent in the post-war experience. So that I think, is a very big problem reflecting the scale on which things will be done. And the other problem which grows out of that is the problem of conventional thinking in Washington, that we're going to be back sometime soon, worrying about budget deficits, worrying about inflation, that we can give something to the cut Social Security lobby, that we don't need to fundamentally reform the financial sector, that we can avoid taking control of banks which are insolvent. That things can be returned to their normal state. There are a whole series of policy attitudes which I'm afraid they are going to find they're going to be disappointed when these things don't come to pass and they're not able to move to that agenda. But the problem is if they don't realize it quickly, they may lose a lot of political capital.
Our guest today, James K. Galbraith, professor at the University of Texas at Austin, author of the brand new book, The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandoned the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too, published by Free Press in 2008, a book I've had great pleasure reading, and I strongly recommend to anyone in our listening audience interested in understanding contemporary economics in America and appreciating, for better or for worse, the situation we are in the United States and in the world today. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Professor Galbraith, the telephone number here at WILL AM 580, 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Our lines are open. Much of the book, at least the first half of the book, Professor Galbraith, you go through the sort of litany of standard conservative economic doctrine of the past 30 or 40 years, much of which has been accepted, as you point out, by liberals, in effect, as well. And you pretty much show how it really doesn't work. It's been rejected, more or less. And I don't want to go through all of it. I don't want this to be an economics class. But there are a couple of points that keep emerging that you've already alluded to that will be coming up soon. So I think it's worth discussing those. And the first one I'd like to talk about, have you address, is this whole budget balancing notion, the idea that the federal government should always have a balanced budget, that that's optimum, that's the morally proper thing to do, that's economically prudent thing to do, and anything less than a balanced federal budget is really irresponsible economics. This seems to be a major concern still in our political dialogue, and it's one that I think you dissect in the book very well. So if you could share your thoughts on that with our listeners.
Well, one of the things I think that conservatives realized very quickly in the Reagan period 25 years ago was that they weren't going to get a balanced budget and they should focus on the performance of the economy. And Reagan actually got it right in the early 1980s by giving pushing through a tax cut which was large enough to overcome the recession that was coming, and then allowing the Congress to take it back when so that the excesses could be trimmed away and you get back to something reasonable by the middle of the 1980s. And the idea here is that that we've had really kept up on the Democratic side much more than on the Republican, that we should be returning to a balanced budget or to a much smaller budget deficit is one which is, I think, it's fundamentally out of touch with the reality that the United States is embedded in the world economy. And so long as the dollar has become a currency that's used as a reserve in a growing world economy, we have to supply dollar assets to the rest of the world. So long as the rest of the world is willing to hold them and willing to increase their holdings, which is generally the case and has been for several decades, the U.S. is going to be running a deficit in its trade accounts just to that extent, and it's going to have to finance that deficit effectively by running a deficit in the public budget. And so the idea that this is a purely internal matter and that there is some that a zero deficit for the federal government is a normal condition is an idea which is obsolete in the financial arrangements that we have in the world economy. And one could go back to an environment in which we were running balanced trade and therefore could have a balanced budget, but it would be an environment in which our living standards would be much lower than they in fact are, and the world in economic system would have to be put on some very fundamentally different basis. It would not be to the advantage of the United States, in other words, to go in that direction. And that's I think, the basic reality here, is that we need to rethink what our norms are for the fiscal posture of the federal government, both in this crisis when we clearly need to have a much larger public deficit. In other words, we need to have the federal government actively involved in bringing on economic recovery, but also for the long term when we should hope that the position of the United States in the world will permit the government debt to grow at least in line with GDP, and therefore, you know, we'll come to look at deficits of a certain size as perfectly normal.
You make a very important point in the book, Professor Galbraith, that the United States being the dominant economic power in the world and really having the dollar, its currency, as the global currency, in effect, gives the United States the ability to run deficits that no other country really has, and that this is something we should take advantage of and not squander. Is that a proper way
but
to put it?
But it not only gives us the opportunity, it makes it basically necessary. It's a very privileged position to be issuing reserve assets because they basically don't cost anything to produce. They don't use real resources. In return for them, we get to import real goods and services from the rest of the world. So that's a privileged position, one which, as I say, creates essentially an environment where the normal condition is you're running a current account deficit and a corresponding budget deficit.
Our guest, James Galbraith, author of the new book, The Predator's State, How Conservatives Abandoned the Free Market, Why Liberals Should Too, professor at the University of Texas at Austin. If you want to join us with questions or comments for Professor Galbraith, the telephone number here, 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. For my money, this book is as fine a contextual book for understanding our current economic situation as just about any I have read, and I've read quite a few of them over the past 6 months or year. And I'd like to just go through another point, Professor Galbraith, you discuss in the book, which concerns tax cuts and the importance of tax cuts and how they've played out politically and the problems with the promises about tax cuts.
Well, for 30 years or so, we've been treated to the idea that we could somehow jigger the tax code so as to produce higher rates of saving, and that this would in turn produce higher rates of investment. And so we've riddled the tax code with preferential treatment for household savings tax-deferred accounts and this kind of thing. And while that obviously it has a certain degree of popularity with the people who build up those savings accounts, it has had absolutely no effect on overall rates of saving or investment, which are not higher now than they were in the 1950s. So the clear conclusion is that as a strategy for it increasing the rate of growth, this is a complete non-starter. And I make an argument which is very thoroughly rooted in a long-standing strain of economic reasoning, that in fact the rate of investment is governed by the profitability of the economy. It rises and falls with the expectations of profitability and growth. Savings adjust to the investment that's going on. It really have very little to do with whether households are feeling thrifty or not, and practically nothing to do with the tax treatment of savings.
So then why the push for tax cuts? Why the obsession, even in our political culture, with whenever there's an economic problem, the knee-jerk response or the immediate response is cut taxes?
Well, it's largely distributional. The push is always to cut taxes on incomes that are disproportionately earned by the wealthy. Poor people don't tend to have private savings to any great extent, so cutting taxes on savings doesn't benefit them. Meanwhile, taxes on working incomes, the payroll tax, has been maintained at a very high level, much higher than required to fund the current Social Security benefits. So we shifted, and we shifted in the early 1980s decisively against the tax system shifted decisively against working people.
My guest today on Media Matters, none other than James Galbraith, you've been listening to, the author of The Predator State. The phone number here at WILLAM 580-333-9455, toll free 1-800-222-9455. We're talking about his new book and about the state of the economy, what can be done and what should not be done. Basically follow the received wisdom of the past three decades in Washington and in economics. Let's go to our phone lines right now to our first caller. Line 1, Western Springs, you're on the air with Professor James Galbraith.
Hello, I'd like to know how you would gauge whether the stimulus is sufficient.
It's an excellent question, and the answer to that, frankly, is we don't know. I can be reasonably confident that the bill, H.R. 1, which is before the Congress now, and which I think should pass, won't be the last word on this matter. And I'll tell you why. What they have done is to look for as many programs as they could find which were already authorized but not yet funded, and then they've placed funds in those accounts. And I think that's a good thing. It saves legislative time. It gets a bill that can be, that's clearly working toward purposes that the Congress has already approved, can be passed quickly, get things moving. But there are not enough of those agenda items out there to meet the condition of the economy, and even if you accept the baseline forecast of the Congressional Budget Office, this bill, which is about 2% of GDP, is being poured into a gap which is considerably larger than that. And I think that, as I argued earlier, that it's likely that the CBO forecast that the baseline is also excessively optimistic. So on those accounts, I think we're going to get this done, and then the appropriate response will be to say to everybody should recognize that it's basically just a first step, and we're going to have to think about things that will require new legislation, new drafting, that can work on a larger scale.
If I can do a little bit of follow-up on that, Professor Galbraith, there on some circles in economists, mostly among what we consider sort of the liberal wing or the Keynesian wing of the profession, such that it remains. There is talk here, as there is in Europe, of the possibility of having to nationalize much of the banking system. Do you think that is a plausible scenario for the coming months or year?
Well, I don't like the term nationalization because it tends to sort of evoke a political agenda. The fact is, our banks are chartered by the government. They are insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. And when they are insolvent, it's absolutely imperative that the FDIC take them over, that it take a very strong hand in the running of these institutions. We have such banks operating in the United States today. IndyMac in California was taken over by the government because it had failed. And what happens then, basically, is they on Friday evening they are closed, and on Monday morning they're reopened with a new name, a new management team. And the regulators go in, and they try and make an objective assessment of the condition of the bank. And they do separate out the bad assets from the ones that are still good, and they take the risk capital that's been in the bank, and that gets wiped out because people who've put their money in are getting the higher returns associated with common equity or preferred shares or subordinated debt are in a position where they are there to take the first loss, and then the bank is reorganized, and it may be broken up, it may be sold, it may be refloated as an independent entity, depending upon what's best in the market conditions, and you try and get off to a fresh start. But there's nothing unusual about this. This is not out of American banking practice. It's, in fact, exactly what the FDIC not only is supposed to do, but actually does when banks fail. What was done in the 1980s by the Resolution Trust Corporation when the savings and loans failed. And so there are models for it, and we should get on with this task.
Do you think it's then something we'll probably have to do?
Oh, yes, I suspect so. I can't imagine. I haven't got privileged access to the books of Citigroup or Bank of America, but I find it very difficult to believe that on a fair accounting that those institutions are still solvent. And it would be, I think, terribly imprudent, if I'm right about that, for the federal government to engage in what's called the practice of forbearance. Because what happens when a bank is insolvent and you leave it in the hands of its existing management is that they have all kinds of incentives to mess things up. They may take exorbitant risks, as they have nothing to lose, in order to try and return to solvency, in which case if those bets go bad, as they tend to do, the losses just get bigger. They may have an incentive to loot the institution. It's a situation in which you get what's called control fraud, which is to say the depletion of the assets of the institution by the top officers. So you have a situation which is inherently, the technical term is criminogenic. It's a situation which invites abuse, and that's why you need to have a change of management. A new team taking control.
Let's go back to the phone lines again. Our guest, James Galbraith, author of The Predator State and economist from the University of Texas. Let's go now to line two. Urbana, you're on the air with Professor Galbraith. Yes, Urbana? I think we've lost Urbana line two along the way. Sorry about that. Let's try line three, Champaign. Champaign, you're on the air with Professor James Galbraith.
Yes, sir. I wanted to follow up on the original question. If you had the 30 minutes with President Obama, what recommendations, you didn't get to part two of it, would you make to the president on precisely how to get to the root of these problems we're having?
Okay, let me go through a few things that I think should be on the list. We've got a bill which needs to pass that will give us some stabilizing spending and some improvement in on infrastructure and these issues, and I think that's a good thing. We should make the state aid to state and local governments basically open-ended. The deal with state and local government should be: don't cut your services, don't raise your taxes, don't lower your taxes. Just hold your situation in place, and the federal government will cover the revenue gaps so that state and local governments are not compounding the problem by cutting back on services and on employment. Next, foreclosure relief. Clearly, a major part of this problem, the problem has its origin in the housing sector. It won't go away until we've stabilized that sector. You can't, in fact, control the price of housing, but you can make it easier for people to stay in their homes. So I would put a moratorium in place, and then I would turn over the problem mortgages to a corporation set up to resolve them, something along the lines of the Depression-era homeowners loan corporation. Okay, third, I would increase Social Security benefits. There's a lot of talk here about eventually cutting Social Security benefits as a kind of clawback to this expansion package. I hope that talk goes away. I think it's dangerous and counterproductive. What we actually have is a situation in which the elderly population has lost, as a group, has lost a great deal of its wealth because of the collapse of the stock market and the collapse of the 401ks. And I don't think it's reasonable to expect that that wealth is going to be restored by a revival of those markets anytime soon. So the way you keep the elderly population both out of poverty and maintain its purchasing power as a group would be to increase Social Security benefits and recognize, frankly, that this is a working system which can be a very important stabilizing force going forward. Then, I guess the final thing on my immediate list is I think you do need substantial tax relief for American working families. And the easiest way to do that is to declare a holiday on the payroll tax, let the government pay the payroll tax into the trust fund so that the Social Security accounts aren't impaired, but basically set that rate at zero for the duration of the crisis. And that has a real advantage over what is in the president's plan, where they're trying to do something quite similar but working it through the income tax, which is that you don't have to wait until tax return time in 2010 before working families see the benefit of it. It would start happening this month. So that would be, I guess, the first four major points on a program that would deal with getting enough purchasing power into the economy to keep fill up some of the holes that are opening up everywhere. I think on the financial side, there's an additional agenda. We talked about that a few minutes ago, but these are the essential things on the spending side.
And I should point out, Professor Galbraith, that your book really has a much broader vision about how to rethink our entire economy, both in terms of environmental issues and greening the economy. But even more importantly, I think the striking part of your book was, I read it, was the notion that we could be a high-wage economy again, that was a matter of policy. That wasn't something outside of our control. And you invoke what you call the Scandinavian model. And I think I'd like you to take a second or two to talk about that, because it was really one of the most arresting parts of the book.
Sure. Well, there are two aspects of this. And this concerns how we think about building an economy that works going forward once we have the current crisis somewhat in hand. And the first concerns understanding the role that regulation plays in a modern economy. And the argument I make is that we've been taken down the garden path in a fundamentally misleading road by a conservative ideology in our lifetimes, which has held that regulation is a burden and that it is something which should be minimized, maybe necessary sometimes, but should always be kept to a minimum. And the argument that I make is that in a complex economy, regulation is what provides a framework that makes markets of all kinds trustworthy and therefore makes it possible for them to function. And that's true for the market for food, for example, where you will not buy lettuce unless you have a reasonable belief that the stuff is not contaminated on the way to market, and you rely on a regulatory framework to assure you of that because you cannot verify it for yourself. And it's equally true in the financial sector where you rely on the SEC and the bank regulators to assure you that you are dealing with fundamentally honest players. When those regulations fail, when the responsibility to do that effectively is abandoned, eventually consumers lose trust and the markets collapse. And I would argue that the same is true for wages. The point about having a reasonable minimum wage, a living wage standard, if you like, is that what it does is put pressure on the more backward businesses in any given sector to become more competitive. And it tends to favor the more advanced, the more progressive businesses, the more technologically advanced businesses, who can, by virtue of the fact that they're more efficient, pay somewhat higher wages. And if you put this pressure on systematically, not in an extreme way, but in a systematic way that's continuous, that people expect to be continuous, then over time, you end up with a better mix in the business sector. You end up with fewer low-productivity firms that are basically trying to get by hiring workers on the cheap, and more higher-productivity firms who are more relaxed about paying somewhat higher wages. And that's the path toward which is, again, what is the Scandinavian model, the path toward a more successful, more competitive economy over time. The other piece of this is planning, and that has to do with the environmental and particularly at energy aspects of the problem that we face. There is, I think, a general recognition now that we're going to have to cap carbon emissions. There is a role for a market mechanism in doing that. But in thinking about how we can best move forward and have a functioning economy with a sustainable energy base, we're going to have to do a lot of redesign, the way we produce energy, the way we consume energy, the way we live, which determines the way we consume energy. And so I would argue that although planning has been a much derogated thing in our culture, we need to face squarely the need to begin to do some of it in order to assure that we have some reasonable prospect of getting over that huge challenge over the next generation.
And I think, Professor Galbraith, you make the point in the book that markets left to their own devices are not very good at planning. That's not really their strength.
Well, markets can't plan. Markets are a representation of the desires and the purchasing power of the existing people, the existing purchasers and sellers, and so they're not representing the interests of people who are going to be around in 20 or 50 or 100 years, and so you need to have somebody, some entity in the system, which is capable of taking that long view and asking what standards should we be setting so that we have an economy, a society, and a planet which is viable for the, for a century hence.
Our guest, Professor James Galbraith from the University of Texas, author of The Predator State. The phone number here at WILL AM 580, 333-9455, toll free 1-800-222-9455. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Let's go to line 4, Crystal Lake. Thank you for your patience. You're on there with Professor Galbraith.
The main thing besides the stimulus bill is to get rid of the general agreement on tariffs and trade and NAFTA, that's GATT, and then NAFTA, which is a North American free trade, which sends all our jobs overseas. And I think that's the big thing besides the stimulus bill. Of course, regulation is the main thing that's been missing, and corporations should not be just for profit, but should be accountable to the area and the country for decent production and not just try and raise the price of stocks.
Well, thank you very much, caller, for that comment. And Professor Galbraith, if I can add to that, because one of the aspects of your book I found most interesting was your treatment of this very issue of these trade deals like NAFTA, the notion of free trade. And I think you provided this somewhat, you put it in a different context than is the contemporary parlance among many liberals and among organized labor.
That is true. With all respect to the caller, think that NAFTA has become a kind of symbol for the industrial decline of the American Middle West, but that its actual responsibility is much less than it's been credited with or blamed for. I think the reality is I was around working on Capitol Hill during the Great Recession of 1982-83, that the collapse of our industrial core goes back to more than a decade before NAFTA. It was the result of a policy of extraordinarily high interest rates, tolerating a deep industrial recession, driving up the value of the dollar, and inviting competition that was initially from Japan and Korea rather than from Mexico. NAFTA didn't come along until, 1994-95. In addition to that, I would also just point out that NAFTA in 1994 did not prevent a return to full employment in the United States by the end of the 1990s. So I think that while I understand that the two phenomena have been really bound up in people's minds very, very tightly, I think it's an appropriate moment now to recognize that we can, in fact, rebuild our economy and put our people to work, as we did in the late 1990s, in spite of the fact that we have a pretty open trading relationship with Mexico, and that we should think about, that our focus should be on how to imagine and achieve that task. And I think we're off to a good start. I mean, people do understand that this is largely a matter of building infrastructure. You can put a lot of people to work that way, of maintaining public services, and of redoing the energy profile of the economy. All of those things are ways of going forward. And I think that our trading environment does not stand in the way of achieving them.
And I guess if I can just finish this point, because it's such an important point in your book and in your argument, the idea that the trade deals are the reason why we have low manufacturing wages, or there's downward pressure in wages, and there's really little we can do about it as long as these trade deals are in place, you don't buy that.
I don't, yes. I think we can set standards and enforce them at home. I think there are some standards that have to be enforced at the border, and that's clear, and they should be enforced. But I think that... One thing one has to recognize, first of all, is that we don't have a free to trade agreement with China, and so our trading relationship with China has got to be considered, you know, an abstraction from this concept of free trade agreements. And secondly, that Mexico, whether we have a free trade agreement with them or not, is not going to disappear. It's right there on the southern border. It's 80 million people. And whatever the Mexicans are doing, they're going to continue to do, whether we change our trading relationship with them or not. So in some sense, I think the question of the legal form of trade deals has been overstated. I do think, though, that we should stop, and I think we will stop, the business of negotiating bilateral trade agreements with a lot of small countries, because those have really nothing to do with manufacturing in the United States, but everything to do with providing some political favors for powerful constituencies like American pharmaceutical firms or insurance companies that want access to markets on very favorable terms. And that is a very predatory activity, which really adversely affects a lot of people in much poorer countries than ourselves.
Let's go back to the phone lines now to some very patient callers. Line 1, Champagne, you're on the air with Professor James Galbraith, author of The Predator State.
Good afternoon. We're honored to have you on deck. I'm not sure that economics can be separated from politics, but with that caveat in place, allow me to proceed. Could you say anything about the role of socialism, if there be any, in terms of balancing the economy? And to flesh that out a bit, let me observe that despite the ugly status of socialism as a tool, I have become convinced that a government funding of the minimum wage is essentially needed to draw jobs back from overseas and from automation. Now, I understand that you want a certain portion of the minimum wage to be covered by the employer, but all? And none of this would represent a 100% application of socialism, which I think we can all agree is wildly inappropriate. But I'm also sensing that a 100% capitalism has become wildly inappropriate, too. Unfortunately, socialism suffers the ghost of Stalin. And I'm just trying to look at where we can put the stimulus right where it's needed, and that's where I see. And I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts,
Professor Galbraith.
Well, I certainly agree with you that the right solution is somewhere in the middle, and I think that is also the solution which has been most successful in American history. I don't like the characterization of the economy that we're in now as being one that is of pure capitalism. I don't think that's an accurate view. We have an immense public sector, which was built for us by Franklin Roosevelt, by Lyndon Johnson, most notably, and which contains many institutions, Social Security, deposit insurance, the housing finance agencies, which have worked reasonably well for long periods of time. The problems that we're experiencing lie in the breakdown of some of those functions, in particular, the complete breakdown of probity in the sector in housing finance. But at the same time, I'm not in favor of placing institutions that work well in a public-private context completely under the state. And I'll give you the reason for it. I teach at a public university, which has a great deal of funding that comes both from the public sector and from the private sector, and some of it comes from the students in the form of tuition. And I think that model works much better than the characteristic model even in amongst our friends in Western Europe, which provides for university funding coming purely from the state. The reason is that if you only are restricted to one such source, the funds tend to be much tighter. They tend to be much more strictly controlled, and there tends to be a much more direct control of by the political mechanism what goes on in that sector of the economy. And I don't think that's to the advantage of a university system, just for example. So I think the U.S. actually has evolved some mechanisms which are flexible, decentralized, which are stabilized by public participation but invigorated by private share. And those are reasonably good models in a lot of areas.
Now, Professor Galbraith, you invoke the Scandinavian model. You discuss Sweden and Denmark at some length in the book. And the point you make in the book, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that those are countries that have much less economic inequality than does the United States, and also have a much higher standard of living for working class people in the United States. Yet those are also full employment economies, largely with free trade, and that they are capitalist economies. They have business-dominating investment. Is that correct?
All true. I don't want to give a false impression. I don't overstate the comparison. I think one can make a clear argument that both Sweden and Denmark, first of all, are very small countries. Denmark is almost exactly the size of Wisconsin in terms of population and location of the country and some other things as well. Making a comparison between the small and the very large countries like the United States is tricky, and I'm not arguing that one can transplant the social welfare institutions entirely from Scandinavia to the United States. The main point I make, though, is that where you have a reasonable control over the structure of pay that gives you a society which is reasonably egalitarian, then you tend to get other benefits out of that, and particularly in terms of productivity and standard of living over time. What happened 70 years ago, Sweden was a country whose income was not better than average for Europe at the time, and as a result of a systematic strategy of keeping the wage structure compressed, it was able to move up gradually to the top of the income pile in Europe, as well as maintaining, as you say, a very high level of employment by comparison with much of the rest of Europe. So it's the principle here that seems to me to be the one that we should carry away rather than the particular institutions of the place.
This is our guest, Professor James Galbraith. We've only got a few minutes left. We have a few callers who have been waiting patiently, and we will do our best to get to all of them. Let's start right away with line two. Urbana, you're on the air.
Why has there been no transparency or accountability of the $350 billion given to the banks? And I think a primary reason would be graft and corruption among the politicians and the bankers.
Professor Galbraith?
I think there should be much more accounting for what has happened to the money, and not just the $350 billion, but the Federal Reserve has taken a couple of $1 trillion of commercial paper onto its balance sheet, and on what collateral is not clear. There are some lawsuits on precisely that issue, and they should be pursued.
Let's go to line three now. Charleston, Illinois, you're on the air with Professor James Galbraith. Yes, Charleston? I think Charleston has left us. Let's go to line one then. Urbana, you're on the air with James Galbraith.
Yes. I'm Betty.
Hello?
Hi. I would like to, I want to mention what's wrong with some of the stimulus going towards states and things to help keep police jobs and things so they won't be laid off. Help with all these people that's unemployed. Help with the college students' Pell Grants. That can stimulate, you know, along with other things, you know. And another thing that I'm concerned about, you know, the Republicans, it seems like to me they want Barack to fail. You have Pence of Indiana and Bunyan of Michigan constantly down on him and complaining and lying when a Barack come out in the public and say he want everybody's support and opinion, and they lying and talking about they ain't involved. And Rush Limbaugh say on the radio all the time he hope he does not make it, hope he fails, you know. I'm getting so sick and tired of these people. It's going to take a while for this guy to be able to do anything because our system is broken. The Republicans just screwed up our country. You hear me? They are full of greed and hate. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
I hear you.
Professor Gellman?
My first priority, and I said it earlier in the show, is to get money into the hands of state and local governments. And this should be done in an open-ended way so that police and fire and librarians and people who run the parks and so on can stay in their jobs. If you don't do this, then you're first of all, you're directly attacking crucial public services that help keep our neighborhoods viable. You're also going to compound the housing problem because people who lose their jobs won't be able to pay their mortgages. So to me, this is vital. There is money in the new bill that would address this, but I would make it open-ended and spend as much as necessary to stabilize the state and local sector right now.
Now, Professor Galbraith, the caller touched on another point, which is that President Obama has gone to great lengths to try to be to govern in a bipartisan manner as much as possible to draw Republicans in to avoid the partisanship which was attended the Bush administration and some earlier administrations. At the same time, in the crisis we're in, where the Republican Party seems to be largely obstinate for the most part, is this going to be an effective way to resolve this crisis?
Well, I think it's a smart way to begin, and it puts the burden on the Republicans to deliver some votes and to not stand in the way. And I think it sends a very clear message to the country that the president is being as accommodating as possible of every point of view. And if that produces political success and economic success, great. And if it doesn't, if there produces obstruction, then it's clear where the responsibility is. So I think in these early days that the strategy of being accommodating has a lot of merit. He's been more accommodating than I would be, but I think there's an argument in favor of his approach, and I'm not going to heckle. I do think, though, that there will come a time when it's clear that further steps are required, and those steps are going to be much more difficult for Republicans to swallow, and there may well be a much sharper divide. But by that time, let's hope the country understands what has to be done and is fully behind it.
Let's go to our final caller now, line 3, Charleston. You're on the air with Professor Galbraith. You only got a minute left, so please be brief.
Yeah, I just wonder if you could address the conservative regulatory position a bit more. I think what a conservative might say to your example about food is that, well, the supermarket could, you know, test the lettuce and then attract customers by saying, you know, we have safe lettuce, a private system. Why doesn't that work?
Well, because it doesn't get trust. You have to have a regulatory authority that the public itself has confidence in. I'll tell you, there's one place in China where you can, in fact, get fresh lettuce, and that is in Walmart, Sam's Club. And the reason is it's flown in from California, and the Chinese consumer knows that the FDA does the job. So it's really a question of having an agency which commands the respect of the market as a whole. Very hard for a private sector entity to do that because nobody really knows who they're dealing with.
Professor Galbraith, we've only got a few seconds left. Just one last question. How quickly do you think the Obama administration, the U.S. federal government, has to move to really effectively take advantage of this moment and implement a recovery package?
Well, the first step should be taken within the next few days with the passage of H.R. 1. But we should be aware that this is not going to be the end of it. It's really just the first step. We're going to have to develop, I think, substantially more by way of expansion programs, and that could go on for years. I don't think we are in an environment where the economy is going to recover quickly, no matter what we do. And so we're going to have to support the president and his team if they move, you know, progressively toward measures that are of the scale and the degree of boldness that I think the situation will require.
Professor James Galbraith, our guest today in Media Matters, thank you very much, sir, for joining us. Professor Galbraith, the author of The Predator State, professor at the University of Texas. I'm Bob McChesney. Thank you for joining me. We'll be back next week with Susan Douglas, our guest. I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer, Kyle Crowe, who's been working the board. Have a great week, everyone. And again, Professor Galbraith, thank you very much.
Podcast. is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, today, snow flurries are likely with a high of 19 degrees. Tonight, continued snow with a low of 12 degrees. Tomorrow, partly cloudy with a chance of snow showers during the afternoon, a high of 22 degrees. Tomorrow night, continued snow flurries with a low of 13. You're listening to WILL AM.